The Ticket.
Podcasts are brought to you in part by Lewis Jewelers, the official jeweler of The Ticket and proud partner of Michigan Athletics.
And we are back, folks, here on the Michigan Insider Sports Talk 1050 WTKA. Online at WTK.com, midweek peak with Steve Clark. And Steve posed the question before we went to the break. Is this Baylor team the best championship team in the past? What, did you go 40 years, Steve, 40 years?
Well, I wanted to have to amend it to say the best championship game performance in 40 years, just because of the way they play defense. The way Gonzaga came in as the number one team in the nation from start to finish, and the way Baylor made this a clinic from the very beginning, a 9-0 run before Gonzaga even knew what hit him. I understand watching Gonzaga and what they do and the way they flow. But Baylor just looked like an NBA team compared to Gonzaga on that particular night.
Yeah, Steve, I just got to go with the running Rebels, dude.
Sure.
That team, we're dating ourselves. But if you were around at that time, man, I had seen dominance like that. And they were so complete because they really could guard you. They could play 94 feet, but at the same time, you want to get them in half court. Larry Johnson was a load in the post. They had shooting with Anderson Hutton, Greg Anthony. They had you want a guy. You need a stopper. Who was a better defensive player than Stacey Augmon? The Plastic Man. They just had it all, Steve. And
Sam, how about they did it with little depth? True. Right? They did it. They did not use a whole lot of bench. They didn't need to. Those guys stayed on the floor, stayed out of foul trouble, ran up and down the floor for 40 minutes, did not go to the bench a lot. But those guys, Steve, that 90 Rebels team, Steve. I was there 91 to watch them lose, and we all thought they were going to win, obviously, when they lost to Duke.
They destroyed Duke.
But if you're talking about, championship game performance, that 30-point blowout of Duke is just, it stands,
You know who gave UNLV the biggest trouble that year in 1990?
It was Marymount.
Ball State.
Oh, yeah,
they got within
Ball State.
Two. They lost off an alley-oop in the final seconds. 2-point game.
Yeah.
I was there.
Yeah, Michigan had beat Loyola Marymount. that probably would have been the matchup.
Right.
But they I just looked it up. They destroyed Marymount, too, by 30.
I know. They blew everybody out.
What did Michigan lose? 149 to 115 that day?
Yeah, it was something like that. Something that made me cry.
115 and you lose. Unbelievable.
And those guys are throwing it up from everywhere. It's like, are you kidding me? This is not fair. They're knocking down these
They
three.
Probably had to run. If they took longer than 8 seconds to put up a shot, they probably had to do suicide sprints or something in practice.
It had me crying. I had the over in Monday night's game. And it was looking really good. I was like, if they can just get 3 points a minute the rest of the way, I'm covered. And then all of a sudden Baylor decided to slow it down. In the last 7 minutes of the game, they started walking it up. I'm going, oh, crap. You just want Gonzaga to make it close so that Baylor can start scoring again. But,
yeah, man, 90 running Rebels, you could go with, I hate to say it, Duke won going away against the Fab Five in 92.
That was a close first half, though, Sam.
It was a close first half.
They were right there with them.
You look at those teams, and you talk about championship performances, and they had some great team performance, some really strong individual play. But then I also think about the big-time players in those championship games. Like I said, Larry Johnson, Christian Laettner being the best college player I ever seen. One of those two teams, and I'm like, Ira, I'm going with the 90 UNLV team because it was just the most – it was so – such domination, such dominance that you just didn't see how this team would lose. It's what makes Duke's upset to this day makes people say UNLV threw that game.
That's one of the biggest upsets of all time.
Yeah, man. How did they win that game, man? Come on, dude.
Hey, speaking of Duke and Christian Laettner, Grant Hill said fairly quickly after Jalen Suggs makes that three, move over, Christian. You know, we got a new, you know, perpetual highlight.
No.
And here's the thing that I've noticed. Gonzaga lost the national championship. For some reason, it doesn't mean as much. Leitner hitting his shot and that team winning the championship makes all the difference in the world in terms of the history of that play.
Who it came against was important, too. Sure. They beat Kentucky and Jamal Mashburn.
Don't you think these I know they're both buzzer beaters at end of games in huge NCAA tournament games, but I think the content, the way the plays happen is also makes it different. I'm not downplaying what Suggs did was phenomenal. We've talked about it here on the air. It was unbelievable. But he didn't have to have somebody throw him a three-quarter court pass on the money and then catch and shoot in 1 second. So the play itself, because you're not wrong, obviously two more wins, Duke wins the championship, and Gonzaga goes to the next game and they lose. So that part is going to be a part of this conversation too. But Grant Hill had to make a perfect throw, and Leitner then had to make the turn the pump to turn into the shot. So I think the plays are also different enough that while I think you're going to see plenty of replays of the Suggs play in pre-game, pre-rolls or whatever, I'm still waiting for something to overtake that Duke. That play, because that is still in 1.1 second or whatever, still phenomenal.
Yeah, I freaking hate Christian Leitner. I mean, I've expressed this to him. Doesn't make me hate on his game, though. He shouldn't even been in that game. He should have been thrown out.
And that's true.
That.
And that is true. People have brought that up too, that he should have been kicked out of the game. But I want to say that as great as the shot was by Christian Leitner, he was like, I think he missed one shot in the game. He was phenomenal in that game. But Grant Hill made the play. Because how many times have we had? There was a couple times recently in this tournament. You can't make that throw, right?
They decided not to play, not to put anyone on the inbounds, man. So that
neither
made
did.
It,
yeah, right.
That's it's what, somewhat easier to make that. He still had to make a great throw. Make no mistake.
But
Grant Hill, let Grant Hill tell it, and he's like, "Why is Christian Leitner? Why is Christian dribbling? Don't dribble. What are you doing?" So clock in Christian Leitner's head. To know he could make a move and then still get the shot off, it just, the whole play stands out.
Two evolutionary things about that play was the one, the idea that you actually can put the ball on the ground, fake one way, and go another with less than 2 seconds. Right now I'm having a concept problem of being able to catch and shoot with 0.4 seconds and still get it off. I'm having a problem with that. But back then, it was difficult for people to conceive that you could catch the ball, put it down, go one way, turn the other, and still do it within 2 seconds. That is a game changer in the thought process that holds to this day. The second one is what Ira mentioned, was that nobody was guarding the inbound man. And everybody now has a different school of thought about guarding the inbound man on that type of play. But my point of bringing this up is this play is so defined in part because the game was so excellent from beginning to end. But in the overall aftermath, Kentucky went on to win the championship. I think after a few days now, we're probably saying that the Suggs thing is not on the same level as Leitner.
They lost.
But would it have changed if Gonzaga had beaten Baylor? Would that even be lifted up higher than it was at the time? Two other things about it that makes it a little bit of different if we're going with the tail of the tape on these two plays. One was after a timeout and a setup and probably another timeout to look at the defense and that kind of thing. And you had this long, long time to wait to see what would happen within 2 seconds. This one that Jalen Suggs made came completely unexpected and off the wall. UCLA just got a second chance rebound to tie it up. And the immediate thought is double overtime. UCLA is destined, and within 3 seconds, Gonzaga throws one up, and it's banked in, and it's a jaw dropper because you just didn't see it coming.
Yeah,
but Steve, I think the biggest point that you made holds true is the biggest buzzer beaters, and obviously because we've seen a bunch of great plays over the course of time, unless it's like was it when Valpo hit a shot at the buzzer, like a super upset, you're going to remember those for a long time. But otherwise, the ones that get that happen for teams that don't win the national championship, or if they don't win a regional final to get to a Final Four, those get lost in history. Because yeah. I would argue that Scotty Burrell to Tate George in 1990 for UConn in a regional semifinal was against Clemson was maybe even better than the Grand Hill. That, and they did guard the inbound on that play. I just watched the replay to confirm it. But they did guard the inbound on that one, and that throw was deeper into the corner for Tate George to make the catch and shoot, and it was exactly 1 second left on that one. But 2 days later, Christian Laettner hits a buzzer beater to send Duke to the Final Four in 91. So, or 90. Of course, they wanted to lose a couple games later that we were talking about. So I think that's the biggest point of all of it, is the greatest shots and the greatest buzzer beaters that we've seen, if they're not from the super underdog teams, they somewhat get lost in history if the team doesn't win the national championship. Because otherwise, we'd talk about Scotty Burrell and Tate George would be household names if UConn had gone on to win the national championship in 90.
I go with Chris Jenkins for Villanova.
Villanova, that's a great one, too. Yeah. Again, winning the national championship on a buzzer, those are the ones that are do last longer because it gets you the whole thing. The reason why the Laettner one will last is it does get you a banner. It got you a Final Four banner. And then they went on to win a championship. If UConn's play over Clemson was a regional final, not a regional semifinal, maybe it lives along even that much longer in lore, too. But I remember the play. I was thinking about it as we're having this conversation. I'm going, but no one ever talks about it. And if you watch the replay of it, maybe more impressive than the Grant Hill to Christian Laettner one, but it was a regional semi, and the team loses 2 days later, so it kind of gets lost.
Yeah. Fun to talk about. Fun to have those memories, and hopefully we're talking about a Michigan team that is back in position to make some more great memories. Even though they it ended with the Elite Eight, it's still a great run, a lot of memories from that season. Come back next year if they can get Sean D and Eli Brooks and add all that athleticism. I mean, because Frankie Collins is, Steve, he is electric when you talk about the bounce that he brings to the table. And Isaiah Barnes is a high flyer. And Musa Diabate, I mean, the finishing ability of next year's team, they will be more athletic. And then you add Caleb Houston shooting to the mix. If you could bring back Eli Brooks and Shawnee Brown shooting, it will be a team that won't be as – they won't have the Isaiah Livers. I guess they will stay. They will still have that experience. They'll be a more complete team. How about that?
Sure.
If Eli and Sean D come back, they'll be a more complete team next year.
I'm excited for the thoughts about that. You know, though, before I move on, you know what our audience is screaming at us right now as we're talking about last second shots and prolific shots in college basketball history?
And we are talking about Trey Jordan. And JP.
We're not talking about Trey, and we're not talking about Jordan Poole.
Yep.
And again, it lends to the argument, if Michigan had won the national championship those years, they would be bigger nationally known plays than what they are now. They are lost to national. Well, Jordan Poole's shot still plays. Trey Burks plays a little bit, but that's now become more of a local legend thing here in Ann Arbor. And
Lawrence, Kansas.
It just goes to show you, if you won the title, I mean, these just plays live on forever.
Trey's will obviously resonate with me more because it was unbelievable.
Separated his shoulder, keeping him in his seat.
The sequence that led up to it, I mean, you had to have a missed foul shot on the other end. And then he brings it down and he shoots it from the parking lot, and it's Kansas. And it's Kansas. That was the you know, big time favorite, and all the Big 12 fans in the stands cheering for him. You know, Michigan, a lot of people had Michigan losing that game. And so
reminder of Michigan fans, when you think your team never wins the big one or never becomes the underdog team to win something, you got that.
Hey, man, I thought we were going to have it. I was like, man, we got to channel JP and Trey for this last shot against UCLA. Was hoping that it would strike again, and ultimately it didn't. Steve, I want to shift gears here real quick before we get out of here and ask you the question that I posed to Ira at the very beginning of the show.
Uh-oh.
And look, the NFL draft is fast approaching.
Okay.
And there is a lot of smoke a lot of scuttlebutt about the best player in this draft, or at least the fastest rising player in this draft, being a tight end named Kyle Pitts. And it went to another level yesterday when Ty McShay, of draft analysis fame, he's Mel Kiper Jr. Jr., as I call him, he said, look, I think he's the guy with the highest ceiling in this draft. Trevor Lawrence is in this draft, Steve. I think that he's the guy with the highest ceiling in this draft. And I think he has a, I mean, this is a guy who could be a future Hall of Famer. He's throwing this on Kyle Pitts. Now, he's not calling Kyle Pitts a tight end. And most people aren't at this point. They're saying he's a big wide receiver. Think Kenny Galladay with 20 pounds and a tenth of a second off his 40. That's what they're saying about Kyle Pitts and the mismatch nightmare he could be at the NFL level. So it has me saying, as much as I'm opposed to taking a tight end in the first round period, certainly not in the top 10, and the Lions have taken a tight end twice in the top 10 in the past 10 years, three times in the first round in the past 15 or so. I think I would budge on this one, Steve. I think I would budge on this one because I'm really, really enamored with the idea of a 6'6", 245-pound guy who could run a 4'4", 4'40 out there creating mismatches game in and game out. I'm just starting to think now he won't even be on the board at number 7 when the Lions draft.
I agree with you. I don't think he's going to be on the board at number 7 either. And they're not going to be drafting him as a pure tight end. They're going to be drafting him mostly as a receiver, not exactly like Gronk, but his, you know, deceased teammate convicted of murder, Adrian Fernandez. He's more of that type of guy. Again, play the tight end position, but he was just a speed receiver with weight going down the field. And I think, you know, the Patriots had something with both Fernandez and Gronk.
Yeah. See, but as good as Aaron Hernandez was as a player.
I said Fernandez. My mistake. It's Hernandez.
Aaron Hernandez is not the freak that Kyle Pitts is. He was really, really good. Make no mistake. Not the freak that this guy is.
Both out of Florida.
Both out of Florida. Still not the freak that this dude is.
Right.
And to the point, and I put this question to Eric Adelson yesterday. Eric works at UF, sees him all the time. He said his wife, Andrea, who writes for ESPN, said she had Kyle Pitts on her Heisman. She thought that highly of him. He said, look, if I had to choose one receiver in this draft, I'm picking Kyle Pitts over Ja'Marr Chase.
Yeah, that's surprising. That part is surprising. But I understand where this Kyle Pitts phenomenon is coming from. I don't think he's going to be available for the Lions at 7. And I'm hoping he is picked up so that the Lions can use a better player slide down the draft for them. Because right now, some of the draft experts have the Lions selecting the third of the top three receivers not named Kyle Pitts. They have, you know, Pitts being taken before. They have Ja'Marr Chase being taken before. Heisman Trophy winner Devontae Smith taken before. And the Lions.
Okay.
Yeah, and the Lions looking like they may have to settle for Jaylen Waddle. And I'm like, you don't have to settle for Jaylen Waddle, guys. You don't have to. Justin Fields might fall down to 7, and that's a real interesting pick. Despite having Jared Goff for at least 2 years, are you going to use all your wealth on that?
No,
Justin Fields could. Look, I'm not rooting. I'm just examining, Sam. I'm just saying that Justin Fields could be available at number 7.
No, Steve. I'll trade it. But you cannot take Justin Fields.
I don't think you can either. But I'm just telling you what's going on in the heads there. And you're also looking at maybe one of the best offensive linemen in a few years coming down the draft, slipping down into the teens. At number 13, Penny Sewell out of Oregon is slipping out of the top 10.
Yeah,
I don't understand it.
Here's the thing. You know, one of the mock drafts I saw this morning, Ira talked about this, had four quarterbacks being taken in the first four picks. So you had obviously Lawrence, Zach Wilson, and then number 3, they had Mac Jones, who's flying up the court.
Because he's the other fast-rising guy other than Kyle Pitts, as Mac Jones has become a late first-rounder to a top-five pick.
Right, right. And so a lot of talk, a lot of smoke about him going to the Niners at number three. And then Trey Lance. Maybe, you know, the Falcons go for Trey Lance at number four and get their quarterback. You know, if that happens, then either Devontae Smith or Penny Sewell, in my opinion, is going to be on the board at number seven. You cannot take Justin Fields with those two guys on the board. You take one of those two. You know, you got so many needs. You say that there is some promise in Jared Goff. This is what they're selling to us. If you truly believe that, then to me, I'm with Justin Fields being the fifth guy on that quarterback list. I just got serious questions about Fields. I got serious questions about Ohio State quarterbacks, period. And I'm not gambling with the number seven pick when I got a need at wide receiver, when I have a need at offensive line, and you got guys who project to, be big time, be starters, be, you know, major contributors, if not all pros at that position on the board, I'm taking one of those guys.
Let me lawyer for the other side. We agree so much, Sam. I sometimes have to just become a lawyer and be devil's advocate. The Lions, I don't think, at least I don't believe Jared Goff is the future quarterback for the Lions. We're committed to him for 2 years because of his salary, and then it's a reset mode again. But where would the Lions be? Where would the Lions be in terms of getting a quarterback of that quality again in the near future within the next 2 years? Most of the top-notch quarterbacks are going to be taken within the top three. This is an abnormal season where a great quarterback could be available at 7, 8, maybe even a little bit below that. Where are the Lions going to be in the draft coming up in the next couple of years where they could get a guy without having to trade up? I don't think it's the smart move to invest your resources into two quarterbacks and pay them a whole lot of money, but maybe that will help them, you know, stay in the top 10 for the next couple of years and continue to accumulate assets and let Justin Fields grow into the position or any quarterback in the position. But if you want a top-notch quarterback for the next 2 years, you're probably going to have to be in the top three. And I think Jared Goff is good enough to keep the Lions out of the top three and, you know, have them hovering around 10 or 12. And then you're kind of stuck for the Lions because you're going to have to need to trade up to get it.
Yeah, look, I hear your point. I think it's a good one. Does not convince me. I think maybe this could be an example of me or us just seeing Justin Fields too much. It's too much of a gamble at number seven, having seen him at Ohio State and seen his flaws show up in the biggest games. I think that he is a guy that's limited as far as his progression reading is concerned. He does not throw guys open. He does not process his progressions. And I think that that is as much a product of the scheme as it is any limitation that Justin Fields might come with. And it could be something that he overcomes rather easily in the NFL. I'm just looking at the guys that came before him, from this scheme. Guys who were supposed to be, I mean, did Cardale Jones ever turn out to be anything? Didn't turn out to be anything. I mean, the quarterback that just got cut by the Washington football team, Dwayne Haskins, didn't turn out to be anything. No. You cannot take him there when you have other needs. And like Ira said, I mean, you could do worse than drafting a franchise offensive tackle. Man, come on. If you were talking about number 17 as opposed to number seven for Justin Fields, all right, I'll go for him at 17, but not at seven.
Clearly, Sam is devaluing Justin Fields.
Or everybody else is overvaluing Justin Fields.
Absolutely. Steve, it is always a pleasure, my friend, as we look ahead. Next week, we'll be talking some Michigan football, maybe, you know, talking about some projections coming out of spring ball. Going to be a spring, I guess we'll call it air quotes, spring game for Michigan.
Spring activities, Sam. Spring activities.
Spring activities. That's a good one. a good way to put it.
There is definitely a, game. I don't think any of us are seeing it, or are you seeing it? I don't know.
No. Ira and I are lobbying for to be guest coaches for spring football at one point. So maybe we can all, you know, take the whole team and call the player too. Jim Harbaugh.
Steve's got the most experience of us calling plays. So
good luck. Good luck on convincing people of that.
Hey man, we're just talking about for like the third string at the end of practice. I put a whole hell of a lot into calling that one play though. But anyway, Steve, as always, a ton of fun, man. Thanks a lot for your time. We'll talk to you again next week.
Sounds great.
All right, that was Steve Clark with the Midweek Peak. Tomorrow, you know how we do Thursdays, folks. We got Hutch. We got the MGO Blog Roundtable. We got the Top Dog of the Week. We have the Recruiting Roundup. We have Bev Plocky, whose team is advanced to the NCAA Finals again. They're regional champs. So a lot to dive into. Looking forward to it tomorrow here on the Michigan Insider on Sports Talk 1050 WTK, The Ticket, the official voice of University of Michigan Sports, Ann Arbor, a Cumulus station.